Okay, House Judiciary is called to order. It's 1:15. And present for the record, we have Representatives Gruenberg, Cott, Wilson, Coghill, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Today is the 10th of February. Can't believe it. Sorry, the 10th of February. And we have three bills up today. The first bill we'll take up is House Bill 343 by Representative Bob Lynn, an act relating to harassment. Then we have House Bill 226 by Representative Guerra, personal information breach. And House Bill 190, required ID for purchasing alcohol, by Representative Crawford. And then just for the committees to remind you, tomorrow we from 10 to noon, and we'll end early if we can. We've got House Bill 373 and then bills previously heard. I'll have Shalon give you an email today about what that could involve, if what's still trailing here. So that'll be our catch-up
Something day. Obscure from last year.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so without further ado, Representative Lynn, we'll have you come up. And I know we've got an amendment from Representative Wilson. I don't have anybody else to testify. We closed public testimony last time. I'd open it up again if there's anyone interested. Is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 343? Is there anybody online wishing to testify on House Bill 343? Okay. So we've made the offer, so we'll go to Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'd like to do is, I think you all have it on your on the desk there, and what this does is just adds that medical personnel would be included, and so it wouldn't stop at the hospital door when, once the ambulance got there, but it would go on into the building and protect the people inside the building also, and then we put a desk in there. So it's we've added medical professional, and then we knew that we would probably have to define what a medical professional was. So we went into that definition. We got the definition from 1141-470 of our statutes right now. And we did add, we took out a few things because that was such a broad definition already in statute. We took out a few things like hypnotist, religious medical healer, chiropractor. We took out a few things that wouldn't fit, and but did add nurse's aide and dental hygienist to the list.
Okay, so you want to move?
I move amendment number
one. Okay, is there an objection to amendment number
just
one?
Just a moment.
Representative
one thing
Gruenberg.
You said caught my ear, and this is going to go on page three, line four. All right, my question, you removed certain things, including hypnotists. I'm hypnotized by the amendment. Hypnotists, who else went out?
Religious medical healer. What I did is I took out so that that wouldn't be so broad that it just, you know.
I thought you said chiropractors went out. Who else? And you put in some people too.
I put in the dental hygienist and nurse's aide because they're in positions where people could spit on them or do something like that pretty easily. So.
Well, the people through the chair, the group that I was concerned about were chiropractors.
They're, as a rule, aren't in a hospital. Mm-hmm. And, you know, usually they're not in the same type of position in of an emergency situation or a medical situation that this bill is kind of working toward.
Would you have a great problem if I amended it to include chiropractors? I move to amend the amendment to include chiropractors somewhere between line 7 and 11 of the amendment.
Hey, there's an amendment to the amendment which would add chiropractors. Is there an objection to the amendment from the committee or discussion? Representative Coghill.
Just rationale on how that might fit into harassment. It would be the same kind of rationale that some kind of blood or body fluid. So they do work very closely with people. There's no doubt about it. So I guess I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Hearing none, the amendment to the amendment has carried. So that brings amendment number one as amended back before the committee. Is there any objection?
I remove my objection.
Okay. So there's no any further objection? Okay. Hearing none, amendment number one carries. Representative Guerra?
Chair, I'm going to have two conceptual amendments.
Okay.
Amendment number two, I move amendment number two, a conceptual amendment. I always forget, I guess I'm supposed to say what this conceptual amendment is first.
Yes.
The whole purpose of the bill is to say that if you attack certain first responders, healthcare workers, correctional folks, all the people listed in this bill, if you attack them, it should be a heightened crime. If you attack them with bodily fluids and the like, spit at them, or worse. And I agree with that. What I want to exempt from this crime and just leave to the standards that we use under existing law is if the bodily fluid is saliva, so if you spit at somebody who's not one of these people in this bill, then this bill doesn't apply. So if you have a schoolyard fight between two 20-year-olds, two 19-year-olds, and it involves one spitting at each other, they can be prosecuted under existing law if the standards are met. But I just want to limit this bill to the people that we want to protect. It's of heightened seriousness when you do these things to a police officer, to a healthcare worker, to all the people we've listed. So conceptual amendment number two would be to limit, when it involves saliva, limit this bill just to the workers who are addressed in the bill.
Representative Gruenberg.
Just a point of order. The bill does apply to everyone. The only difference between the enumerated professions and everybody else is that there's a mandatory minimum jail time. But if I were to spit on you, it would be a Class A misdemeanor. And if you happen to be a correctional officer or a dental hygienist, then you'd then I'd get a minimum jail time.
Right. Under existing law, in order to prosecute somebody for spitting, which we generally don't do if it's a schoolyard fight, but
only in Singapore.
That's I forget what crime Susan Park said they prosecute that under. Some sort of lesser degree of assault, I think. I want to force for spitting. I want to leave the existing law in place, except when it involves the people in this bill. When it involves the professions in this bill, it should be the heightened crime that is addressed in this bill.
Any
so I'm trying to exempt
any?
The schoolyard fight from this bill.
Will you come forward and interject some?
Don't tear it out.
Department of Law.
This will be one of your more memorable gavel-to-gavel moments, your comments on spitting. And please, no more laughter from the audience. This is
what
serious.
What is the penalty in Singapore for spitting? I think it's high.
No demonstration.
It would probably be a simple fourth-degree assault, wouldn't it?
Actually, it's...
I believe it's... my name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division. I believe now we would prosecute under harassment, which is a Class B misdemeanor.
That's what it was.
And that would be subjects another person to offensive physical contact. So...
Thank you. Inquire, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Is fourth-degree assault a Class B or Class A?
Through the chair, it's a Class A misdemeanor.
You could get them for an assault, too, couldn't you?
We could try. I think generally we prosecute under harassment, though.
Really? But it legally would be an assault, I think, too, just as a matter of law.
I suppose it would depend on the facts. We could look at the facts and see.
Okay. Representative Kira?
Yeah, did it make sense, the amendment that I explained? Thank you.
I think it does. Representative Gruenberg, are you satisfied?
Well, I'd like to hear what the sponsor has to say.
Well, as a sponsor, I prefer to leave it the way it is. I think I don't think we have to describe what kind of offense spitting is, and I think it is legitimate to be included under offensive, you know, under bodily fluid. Now, I'd like to leave it the way it is. It's up to the committee, of course, but I think spit should be included here. Or saliva. I guess collective saliva is spit.
Representative Gruenberg?
I'd like to put on the record, I think I may have before, that my son Daniel's in a boarding school, And part of what they have to do as part of the leaders in the boarding school is they have to, this is a, for kids who've had problems, they have to physically restrain some of the children. And there's one boy there who takes out his anger on the other children who are there to restrain him by spitting. And he has caused my son to have bronchitis. And I don't know if that's a conflict of interest, but I have an oar in this boat. I am concerned about that because it causes diseases in the victims, or can.
Through the chair, I would just like to amend my answer to Representative Gruenberg. I've just been looking again at the fourth assault in the fourth degree, and I think it would be unlikely that we would be able to prosecute spitting as assault in the fourth degree unless the circumstances were really extreme.
I see.
Now, because it says you can recklessly cause physical injury to another person. Now, disease, that would be something that we'd have to
figure out. So you'd have to show that the person was injured, like Daniel. Okay. Well, then I do have a problem.
So Annie, walking through the scenario that we had in our first hearing and then today, where you've got two kids on a, I don't know, high school parking lot or something that spit at one another, today, if it were prosecuted, I think it's highly unlikely it would be. I'm hoping it would be highly unlikely, but if it was, it would be prosecuted as harassment, which is a Class B. But under the new bill, then, it could be ratcheted up.
Correct, to first degree harassment, because that is with a bodily fluid.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, and then just one other final question. You heard Representative Guerra's conceptual amendment. I've never seen that done yet, where you kind of bifurcate it, but do you see any problems with that?
I think you could do it I'd have to look to see if there are other similar situations, but if you wanted to keep it a Class A misdemeanor, you could do that and at the same time make that particular instance of first-degree harassment not come under the mandatory sentence provisions. I think it could be done.
And that's the amendment. Okay, further, so that's conceptual amendment number 2, which would keep, confine the bodily fluid reference to saliva anyway, and the mandatory minimums that accompany it would confine it just to the class of people that we have discussed in the bill, and then also the new class that Representative Wilson's amendment added, and leave the original crime of spitting to a Class A misdemeanor. Is that right?
Class B, is that right?
Class B misdemeanor.
Well, it would depend on what you wanted to do. If you wanted to exclude bodily fluids like saliva from the first degree, then you could do that, and then it would remain a Class B misdemeanor.
Remain a Class B misdemeanor just for spitting when it doesn't involve the people that are addressed in this bill, the professions that are addressed in this bill.
Then you'd have to go into both. You'd have to do some amending of the statute.
That's what I'm saying. It's a bit complex, but so, okay. Representative Coghill.
So kind of what I'm seeing here is that if the intent of the bill is that if somebody intends to infect somebody with these bodily fluids, spitting or whatever, we limit it to this, then if you have a person who is somehow a guardian or somebody of a child and then they would end up having this done to them, they would be exempt if we pass this amendment. And so what the thing I'm thinking is everybody who at some time in their life is going to be called upon to either protect somebody or be a part of guiding them through something and would find this kind of contempt put upon them and wanted to charge them, except for the list that we have here, they would be out of this, and they would have to go to a B misdemeanor, if I understand correctly. And I'm saying this out loud so I can get the mental picture, which is which would probably be not charged in the degree that we're asking. So I'm curious. Once you start defining a group of people, then you're by necessity excluding a group of people too. And I want to know, why are we excluding other people if this kind of circumstance is put upon them? And at this point, I would speak against the amendment because I don't know that we want to have just that one group when in our day and age, there are a whole range of circumstances that could happen where this kind of contemptuous behavior might be put upon them. I think they should have remedy. So I'm saying that partly to the sponsor. I'm trying to figure out if my understanding is correct. And if it is, if it's a policy call that I have to make, I want to make sure that just by having this group of people, we're not saying somebody else couldn't charge. And if I understand the amendment correctly, Representative Guerra, what you're trying to do is just limit it to professional people who might end up handling somebody and exclude everybody else who might have some contemptuous act put upon them. They would have to go another way of remedy. Is that what I understand correctly?
Yeah, for the people who aren't listed in the bill, they'd still be able to charge under harassment. And if they had an infectious disease and they were spitting at you because they were even being much more spiteful, that would actually probably be able to be charged under a more serious crime, at some sort of the intent to cause serious physical injury.
Or through reckless endangerment.
And that's the question I was asking.
So they would still be protected under the more serious other crimes that exist on the law. We're just trying to exempt the sort of schoolyard fight from...
And through the chair, it is a policy decision. If you're giving special protection, more protection to a certain group of people, it's a pure policy call who you want to include in that group.
I guess the question is, do we want to exempt a school fight under this condition? There are times when I think it would be not able to withstand the test of going into court, but there may be times where it will. So I'm probably at this point, I'm just going to say the law of general applicability in this case gets me.
Further discussion? Okay. Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number 2, please?
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
No.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Cott?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Representative Guerra?
Yes.
Yes, 4-0.
Okay, and so amendment number 2 fails to carry. Further amendments?
Madam Chair, we did some research on this one. I'm going to move conceptual amendment number 3. This is the last one.
Okay.
I always thought that there was a defense if you were provoked. So then if you respond to somebody when you're provoked, it wouldn't be a crime. But I don't think that's clear in the law. So conceptual amendment number 3 would be this is a heightened crime. Except I would want to put in at the end, except when the victim was the initial aggressor. And we have that in the self-defense statutes, the bill that Representative Coghill is working on. You generally have the right to self-defense, except you lose it when you're what's called the initial aggressor. There are circumstances, they're rare, but there are circumstances where you push somebody around just to get a reaction out of them, or you push somebody around just because you can. And if the response is that you get hit back for doing that, I don't think you should be able to charge the crime. So I want there to be an exemption where just in the case of saliva, where the victim was the initial aggressor.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson and then Representative Gruenberg.
I have an objection. We have a tendency to think that spitting is no big deal. But when it could potentially lead to death, then it is a big deal. And I think that society has to realize that that's a big deal. It didn't used to be a big deal, but now in today's world, it is a big deal. And I think that's the difference for me. And so, I think I have a hard time with it because of that. It doesn't make any difference. There should never be a time that you do that, never, because of the potential problems, and our society today needs to realize that. There's been a change.
Representative Gruenberg.
If I may dialogue for a minute with Ms. Carpinetti. One thing that is a real problem in my part of Anchorage are gangs. And sometimes these gangs get together and they fight. And sometimes people die. Other times less harsh things result. But they're difficult crimes to prosecute because you don't know who started it and who is doing what. It's a big fight, and then the police are, and these are the uniformed police, they're just tasked with being there and trying to figure out what went on. And I'm just wondering, with all due respect to Representative Guerra, whom I really respect a lot, I am concerned about the practical implications of this in a Mountain View gang situation. Would this make it difficult to prosecute if we adopted the Amendment 3?
Through the chair, I was just looking at our self-defense statute now because, you know, you don't think about it in terms of schoolyard fights. But as a matter of fact, it would apply to this situation. And I would much prefer, and I think people who practice criminal law would much prefer not putting it in a substantive statute, but relying on the justification statutes that we have already in place.
Self-defense statute would allow you to...
I think it would. I mean,
what statute are you on?
I'm looking at 1181.330, and it's unusual because I've never thought of it in that way. You always think of self-defense in terms of, you know, serious physical, you know, serious person crimes against a person, and not to say that this isn't. I think that it does. It's not limited to serious crimes against a person.
Are you in a specific subsection?
A1 or A2. A1, I'm sorry.
Ms. Carpenter, if you're comfortable that somebody who is provoked would have a defense, then I'm fine with it, and I'll withdraw the amendment.
I just, it's hard to, it's hard to think, well, spitting back is self-defense, and I guess I would like to give it some more thought. And that's what you're talking about, right?
Representative Gruenberg?
Maybe we in this committee could either have a letter of intent or something like that to try to accommodate what you're both saying. I don't know what would be helpful in this. I am sympathetic to what you're saying, but I'm sympathetic to what you're saying.
Representative Coghill.
How would that be viewed? Because in the matter of self-defense, you would try to disarm yourself or put yourself away from harm's way. But to excuse somebody for retaliation under the guise of self-defense, would we make that distinguish in law?
It's really difficult. I've never thought about it in this context. My concern mainly is not to put a justification in a substantive statute, because that's something that we have never done. I guess I could give it some thought and see if I could come up with something creative to do. Usually self-defense is pushing somebody away, and getting them away from you. It's not fighting back, but I suppose it would be considered mutual combat if they're both two people on the schoolyard are doing it.
Sorry.
It's a tough one.
Madam Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
It's okay. I know it's painful.
It sort of goes in the category of we should be careful when we're writing these laws. And right now, the bill now covers the 5-foot-tall 18-year-old who's pushed by a 6-foot-tall guy and spits back. And now the 5-foot-tall guy, I worry, is a criminal, even though I don't think he should be. So... I'm uncomfortable, but I don't want to be the only person here expressing that concern.
No, and maybe what could happen is between, it goes to finance next, and then certainly to the floor, is that Ms. Carpenetti could do some thinking about it and get back to Representative Guerra, and maybe there is an amendment that could be crafted that we're not thinking of right now. Okay, so amendment number 3 has been withdrawn. Are there further amendments to House Bill number 343.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'd just like to put on the record, for the record, that I appreciated Representative and Ms. Carpenter talking with me about the McKillop case. I'm not going to offer an amendment, and if at any point the Department of Law would like to pursue that, I'm happy to do that with them. We haven't had a chance to talk, but I'm not going to pursue that, but I wanted to thank you on the record.
Any further amendments or discussion on House Bill 343? Representative Cott, you want to move it?
With that, Madam Chair, I guess I can move it. So I would move that we move House Bill 343 as amended out of this committee, individual recommendations, and accompanying fiscal note.
Okay, is there an objection to the bill moving out of this committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes? Okay, hearing none, the bill is moved. Congratulations, Representative.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill will go a long ways protecting those who need to be protected.
Thank you, and thank you to your staff and to Ms. Carpenetti. Okay, that brings us to House Bill number 226 by Representative Guerra.
Chair.
Oh, are you going to come up to the testimony stand? Huh. Testifying stand?
I don't know if I've ever presented my own bill to my own committee.
Oh, you don't have to. It'd be kind of fun, though, wouldn't it, guys?
Thank you. House Bill 226 is a bill we've been working on to address a serious issue that has hit the public consciousness over the last couple of years, and that's when financial companies that make money off of trading your information and holding your information and supplying your information to others, your personal information, your Social Security number, your driver's license, your credit card number, your bank account number, when these companies have a security breach and then release your personal information to third parties. And a number of other states, I think at the time we started this bill, only three or four other states, but by now close to a dozen other states have responded, and they've put in place two very simple, very straightforward protections for consumers. Some states are thinking about going even further, and I think some have, and they've responded with provisions that I've got to say I don't yet understand the implications of. But the two most simple and straightforward and necessary provisions they've adopted are this. When a company releases your financial information accidentally because they know somebody stole it, even if it's not their fault, but they know that all of a sudden your Social Security number is out there, they should have an obligation to notify the person that their information has been breached. It's very simple. You would, if any of us knew about that, we would do that. But the odd thing is that corporate America isn't doing that. And so there was this big case involving a company called ChoicePoint about a year and a half ago. About 145,000 people had their security breached. The company knew about it. And somewhat rapidly, they told the victims in California about it. But they didn't tell the victims anywhere else. And that's because they had to tell the victims in California. California had a law that said if there's a security breach, you have to tell the consumer right away. So you had this odd circumstance where they told the California victims but didn't tell the Alaska victims. And so we've modeled our bill on the California law and said from now on, if there's a security breach that you know about, you need to tell the victim. That's part one of the bill. Part two of the bill says that you should have the right, as somebody who's concerned that your security has been breached, you have some indication that somebody has stolen your Social Security number or your financial account information, you should have a right to call the three credit reporting bureaus, the three national clearinghouses, and put a freeze on them releasing your credit information to another person. And so that's called the security freeze provision, and that's also just taken from the California provision with some very minor word changes. What will happen is you find out your credit card information has been stolen or your bank information has been stolen. You're worried that somebody is going to go out and buy a car with your financial information. Well, normally if they buy a big ticket item, they have to do a credit check on you. So the imposter person goes into a car dealership. They try and buy a car under your name. The car dealership will, before extending credit, call the credit bureau on you. The credit bureau would then at that point say to the car dealer, I'm sorry, the information on this person has been frozen. There's a security freeze because they're concerned that somebody is walking around with their information. So you can protect yourself against the person who's stolen your information from making big ticket purchases by putting a freeze on your credit information. Those are really the two provisions that the bill addresses.
Okay, we have, thank you, Representative Guerra, and we've got some amendments. Let's take the two folks I have in the audience to testify their testimony. Mr. John George. George. If you just, we know you, but if you'd state your name and your affiliation today for the record.
Thank you. My name is John George. I'm here today representing the American Council of Life Insurers. First, let me say we've been working with Representative Guerra last year, and he's been very accommodating in listening to our concerns, and the bill, I think, is much better, this version, than it started out with. So we really appreciate the fact that we've been able to have dialogue with him, and that the bill has improved from our standpoint. I do have two minor things that I'd like to talk about. They're both in the definition section, page 11 and 12. Under A, definitions, A requires a combination of an individual's first name and initial and another element, a social security number, a driver's license number, whatever. But you go to B on the last page, and it says it may be that just that one element, not the combination of the name and the element, but just the element. And I mean, it's either has to be one or the other. Either you got to have a name and a social security number, or you just need the social security number. But I think it's ambiguous that way, and I suppose you'd have to say then a social security number would be an element, and if a social security number got out without any other identifiers, that it could be a breach of security. So I think B could be removed and would improve the bill substantially. The other thing is that it says information that's not encrypted. Well, I'm unable to find a good definition of encryption, and I think if we broaden that by just saying or secured by another means rendering the information unreadable, that covers today's technology. Future technology may keep us from having to come back and amend the bill later. I don't think it does harm to the bill. The whole purpose is that information that somebody can read gets out. It ought to be subject to this. If it's unreadable, probably doesn't make a difference then. Thank you.
Very much. Questions? Comments? Representative Coghill.
Just on the citation of that, where he's unreadable again, I didn't catch the page, line number.
Okay, page 11. Line 21 that's the combination.
That's 23.
Line 23, encrypted. And we would take out or redacted, be comma redacted, or secured by another means rendering the information unreadable.
You have that. Is that part of your amendment to the chair? Is that part of the Guerra packet of amendments? I don't know what your position, Representative Guerra, is, but if you support this, maybe while we're going through the amendments, Mr. George could write that out for us so we have something in writing.
We could get it to the committee aide to have it copied out or something.
Representative Guerra, do you have a...
Yeah. Madam Chair, I don't think either of the amendments are needed. Encrypted is used in California. I don't think anybody's had a hard time defining encrypted. If you say so that the person can't read it, that's vague because you might be able to read something. You know, the encryption might be A6943. You can read it, but now all of a sudden you're making it something that is a security breach because you can read it. That's why we use the term encrypted. Encrypted means if there's if there's been a security breach of a number that, that nobody knows what it means, then it's not really a big deal. So if folks want to work on a definition of encryption, they can, but I don't think it's needed, and I think the proposal makes things worse rather than better. We want to say that it's a security breach when certain personal information is released. Part of it has to be the person's name. We don't really want to regulate it if the person's name's not associated with the security breach. That's just not really a big financial or big security concern. Except, I suppose, there can be times where, so that's why the on page 11, it's two pieces of information that have been released, your name and then some identifying information, your bank account, your Social Security number. That's a big concern. The catch-all in B says, however, there might be some circumstances where even just the release of one piece of this information is a danger. And you can imagine where just releasing somebody's credit card number or bank account number by itself could be a danger to the consumer. So that's why the state of California put the section B in there as well. I don't know why you would not want to protect a consumer if a piece of information standing by itself would be sufficient to allow somebody to engage in or attempt to engage in the theft of the individual's identity. If it's a piece of information that endangers the consumer, I think that standing alone is a breach. And really, again, all you have to do is tell the consumer.
George?
I guess I would maintain my comments. Either getting a individual piece of information, not in combination, if that's a breach, then that's a breach. But how does one determine which is which? I mean, if you say you have to have these elements, you have to have the name and one of these, then you say, okay, I know exactly if I've released that information, that's a breach. But maybe I've given a number. It's somebody's Social Security number, but nobody knows whose it is. Is that a breach or not? Well, it might be, or it might not be. And I think under B, you could say, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Do I have to notify people or not?
Sure.
Representative Kira.
Yeah, it's the reason why this really isn't burdensome on business is if any of us found out that we had released information like this on somebody, we would tell the person. The things that you have to tell a consumer about are if the individual's account number has been released. That's serious. I hope you would tell somebody. If their credit card number has been released, that's serious. I hope you would tell somebody. Access codes and passwords. If those have been accidentally released and you know about it, I would hope you would tell somebody. So remember, the bill only applies if you know the information has been breached, and then all you have to do is tell the consumer. So I don't think any company is going to have to sort of sit there and pull their hair out and go, shoot, we released somebody's Social Security number. Should we tell them? I think the answer is yes. It's a courtesy.
Final response?
I think both of our comments are clear. I think yeah. It's up to the committee to decide.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you. Okay. I have only one other person to testify in the room. Lisa Corgan? If there's anybody else, go ahead and sign up because I don't have you.
Madam Welcome. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Lisa Corrigan. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Alaska Pacific Bank, which is a small community bank headquartered in Juneau. I also serve as the President of the Alaska Bankers Association, which has 9 member Alaskan banks, and that includes banks that are state and federally chartered. Alaskan bankers share the concerns of the bill sponsor, Representative Gara, and I'm sure of those of you in attendance as well. And we are dedicated to protecting the privacy and security of sensitive customer information. In fact, our reputation and the safety and soundness of the banking industry depends on a foundation of security and integrity. And we know that we have a fiduciary responsibility to our customers, not only to protect their money, but also to protect their sensitive personal information. So I can assure you that we take security breaches and all of the related issues very seriously. My comments pertain really to just two parts of the bill, and both of them appear in Section 1, Disclosure of Breach of Security, on pages 1 and 2. And that's as far as I need to go, because we think the best of the rest of the bill is great. Our concerns, we feel, have been adequately addressed by proposed amendments that I believe are going to come before you today from Representative Gara. So I did want you to know that in advance. And we're grateful that he's been so responsive to the feedback from the banking industry, and I think it's working. So we're talking about disclosure of breach of security, and the first paragraph of the legislation appears to appropriately require disclosure of a breach of security if sensitive personal information is reasonably believed to have been acquired by an unauthorized person. I think that wording is great, but it's doesn't go further to stipulate that the information's actually been accessed for unauthorized purposes. And so that's where we have a little bit of a difference from the banking guidance that we're already operating under. And since we are already subject to a pretty complicated web of federal and state regulation, we would like to see new legislation that's consistent with what we're already following whenever possible. Just to give you a little bit of background, I'm sure all of you remember the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which kind of started from 1999, so it goes a ways back. But in that legislation, the banking regulators were required to issue guidance and to continue issuing guidance to banks that would require us to create information security systems. And more recently, guidance came out that directed us to complete a comprehensive risk assessment that relates directly to the subject of this bill. It's on the likelihood and vulnerability to unauthorized access to sensitive customer information, which is a security breach. That's exactly what we're talking about. And to subsequently develop and implement a response program. So it's basically disaster response in an electronic format. Anytime that we felt there was reason to believe that there could be harm to a customer or a customer base. And the standards are in the form of interagency guidance that we're already directed to follow, and it's really quite complex. So I know that other industries may not be operating under that kind of regulation, but we already are. And in a way, it's sort of helpful in this case. But the response program requires us to invoke an immediate investigation if we believe that a security breach may have occurred, and then we're required to determine the likelihood that the sensitive information has or will be misused. And a concern here is that it is possible that an unauthorized individual could inadvertently come into contact with or come into possession of sensitive information without meaning any harm, and we want to make sure that I know that's not the intent of the bill, but we want to make sure that language is consistent with that, because if the bank determines that it's reasonably possible that misuse will occur, then we're already required to go through the notification process to customers, banking regulators, federal authorities, etc. And the Alaska Banking Association supports Representative Gara's proposed amendment because we believe it clearly addresses this issue, and that it clarifies that the information was accessed for a purpose not authorized by the state resident. So that kind of clearly adds the other piece that we needed to say, that it's an unauthorized person has unauthorized access to and is using information for unauthorized purposes, or there's reason to believe that they could. So we think that that's good language, and we support that. The second issue is actually even simpler. It's also in Section 1 on page 2, currently lines 7 to 10, and it's an exception that's provided for a delay in disclosure to customers if the Department of Law has an ongoing investigation and they need, for security or confidentiality reasons, for you not to disclose information yet. All we're asking is that exception be broadened to include all appropriate law enforcement agencies, because we're already required to have a lot of contact with federal authorities when there is any type of criminal activity suspected or ongoing. And we also believe in this case that Representative Garo's proposed amendment resolves this issue as well in very clear language. So I would conclude by thanking you for the opportunity to provide input on the bill. with the inclusion of the proposed two amendments from Representative Gara. We think it's good legislation, and we hope it passes. Thank you.
Lisa, questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify in House Bill 226? Is there anybody online? Okay, so public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. Representative Gruber.
Just for your information, I had asked Emily a question that she's looking up. My question focuses on page 12, lines 3 to 5, and my question was whether that and she's looking up the answer. I'm just letting the committee know what she's doing. Whether that language is word for word from California or whether some of our legal counsel may have changed the language a little bit. So that she's giving me the answer on that. The reason I'm, just so you know what my concern is, I support the bill and what you want to do with it. The way it seems to read is, it's a crime as if it's a crime. You know, this is an identifier if it's sufficient to cause a crime, which is a circular argument. And that's why I'm asking her to look at that. What does it say there?
Okay, Representative Guerra, let's start plowing through your amendments. Which one do you want to take?
Why don't we do the one that says to page 5, line 2, following A.
Susan, you have all the. This one is the smallest one, so most white on your paper. Look for that. Amendment number 1 by Representative Guerra.
How many amendments do you have?
I think it's like 5 or so.
Okay, so this is, I'm sorry, it's.
Page 5, line 2, following A, delete consumer, insert credit.
Got it.
Move amendment number 1, Madam Chair.
Okay, is there an objection?
I'll object to hear it.
Okay.
Amendment number 1 corrects a typo. The bill applies to credit reporting agencies, and at line 2, we accidentally refer to it as a consumer reporting agency. It should be credit. So that's the first part. The second part, I think, is a redundancy. Page 11, line 16. The second part... at page 11, line 16, what we're trying to say is if there's a part of this law that conflicts with federal law and is therefore unconstitutional, only that part should be deemed unconstitutional and the rest of the bill shall remain in force. And that's with this amendment, that's just the cleaner and more appropriate way to say it.
Right. The objection?
Objection is removed. Further objection? Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah, just a couple questions here. The term preemption, the legal term preemption, includes all things that are in conflict with federal law. I think as a matter of law, there's nothing that is in conflict with federal law that wouldn't be preempted. I think that's just a tautology. Isn't that what you're saying? That's always the case.
Are you saying that you support the amendment, or you
support the amendment? Yeah. Okay. Because I think I did have a question about that section. Isn't that always the law? And I'm not suggesting we don't have section 300 in, but I think that's always the law. We could always put that in every bill that may have interstate implications. That's almost the kind of thing you'd want in Title I. I'm not saying it shouldn't be here or that I'm going to mess with the bill. I'm just bringing it up because when I read it, I said, that's something, I don't think you necessarily need to put that in a statute. That's just Hornbook law. If you have something that's preempted, it's unconstitutional, and you have the general severability clause, that would strike it down anyway.
I'd certainly be receptive, I think, on the floor if you show that there's a general preemption provision like this that works just the same way, we can take it out. But
there isn't. And my question is whether at some point the committee would want to consider that addition to the general rules of statutory construction in Title I. I'm just talking out loud to you guys.
I think I'd like to have that debate separately.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And just in terms of precedent, I mean, something that is similar is severability, and sometimes this committee has chosen to put a severability clause into a bill specifically, and sometimes we allow for the fact that severability is a given and that it's referenced, and so we do it both ways. I don't disagree with Representative Gruenberg that the general rule is that if there's a federal law in the particular subject, that it would be preempted, or pardon me, it would preempt state law. But actually, I think it's really is more complicated. I can't remember all of it, but I think in certain areas it is. I think there's certain areas where federal law always preempts state.
Yeah, you're right.
Then there are some others that doesn't. And there's a hierarchy and
complicated.
It takes me too many years back.
Chairman, I wouldn't want to concede anything I didn't have to concede.
And I hear you. So I think it's appropriate to have in, and I think in this case there is a really comprehensive federal law that addresses a lot of the subject matter here, so it seems appropriate to keep it in. Okay, so is there any further objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing none, amendment number one carries. Amendment number two, Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, amendment number two addresses the concerns that the last testifier read through the record, and this is the one that says page 1, line 12, following person, and page 2, line 7, following enforcement. So I move amendment number 2.
Objection to hear.
Okay. Objection to hear. Representative Guerra.
It clarifies, the first part clarifies that if there's been a breach, but it's a harmless breach, like one employee sees a social security number of a consumer and then shows it to their coworker, but their coworker doesn't do anything with it, they don't send it out to the general public, then that's not a breach. And so that's the limiting part of the first part of the amendment. It's sort of, if there's no harm, the bill shouldn't really apply. The second part of the bill says, there's a provision in the California law that we have that says if a law enforcement agency says we're in the middle of an investigation, we don't want you to tell people about the security breach, then it's okay for the company with law enforcement's okay not to tell people about the security breach. The last testifier pointed out, though, that the moment that law enforcement tells the company, okay, now it's okay to tell the consumers, they should go ahead and tell the consumers. So the bill as written would let law enforcement say, hey, we have a concern, you don't have to tell the consumer. When law enforcement satisfies their concern, there's still no obligation to go tell the consumer. So the point is that once the concern is finished with at law enforcement, then you have to tell the consumer.
Only thing I just want to clarify on the record too, Lisa and I had the discussion in my office with part one of the amendment. I just want it to be clear on the record that I wouldn't want this to be used as an excuse. And one of the things I remember in the Choice Point case was that the automatic defense was, well, we knew about the breach, but we didn't think that there was any harm. And that was the defense. And so, you know, we were required under California law to notify consumers, but we weren't anywhere else, and we didn't think there was a harm. I'm fine with the amendment, but I just want it to be very clear on the record that there's a duty that they have to investigate the reasonableness of whether this would cause harm, and that it isn't an automatic defense to simply say you didn't think it would. So with that. Representative Gruenberg.
I'd like to focus on the very last sentence of the amendment. However, the business or governmental entity shall notify the state residents as soon as notification will no longer interfere with the investigation. The first sentence, and I'm only focusing on the second part of the amendment now. What you've done in the first sentence is requiring the law enforcement agency to provide the business or governmental agency with a written request for a delay. That triggers their duty not to disclose, and that makes it sure they have a written record that says stop it. The second sentence doesn't have anything like that, and I think we should say change it around a little bit, and this is a conceptual amendment to the amendment. If Representative Garra is agreeable, that as soon as the investigation is completed or there's no further need for confidentiality, the investigating agency shall notify the business and the governmental agency that they can disclose, and at that point they must disclose, so that they don't have to guess at whether a secret investigation maybe is over. They'll be given a written notice, and that triggers their duty to disclose. Same principle.
Representative Garra?
I don't see the problem as it is. I think you're indicating that when the government finishes their investigation, they might not tell anybody, but that second sentence says they have to, that the business, that both the business and the governmental entity, when they find out the investigation is over, the entity has to tell the business and the business has to tell the consumer.
I read there being three parties here. There's the consumer, there's the business or governmental entity, and then there's the investigating agency. And what I want is a duty put on the investigating agency to notify the business or the governmental agency so they know then they have to notify the consumer. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so at this point, I would ask a conceptual amendment to rewrite the final sentence beginning, however, the business, to say that the investigating agency, the investigating law enforcement agency, I'm sort of doing this on the fly, Madam Chair, the investigating law enforcement agency shall notify the business or governmental agency, governmental entity, as soon as the as soon as the investigation is sufficiently complete that the business can notify the consumer.
Yeah,
and at that point, they must notify the consumer.
My concern about that amendment is that investigations can take decades, and I personally prefer the language of will no longer interfere with the investigation.
Fine. Yeah, good.
Because I think, you know, that is more beneficial to the consumer.
Let's use that language. As soon as notification, what were you saying, will no longer
no longer interfere with the investigation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask
Representative
Garra how he felt about this. How does it feel to have your own bill amended by the Groombergian approach?
Let's finish this for you first.
Okay, no, please.
As soon as such a small, easy amendment, I don't think you need to write it down.
As soon as notification will no longer interfere with the investigation, and at that point, the business or governmental agency must notify the consumer.
My committee aide hates you, but
I love her.
So there's the conceptual amendment to the amendment. Is there an objection to the conceptual amendment to the amendment rewriting the second part? Representative Garra, do you have an objection? He's acquiescing. Okay. Any further objection? Okay. Hearing none. The conceptual amendment to the amendment carries. That brings amendment number 2 as amended, conceptually, back before us. Is there any further objection to amendment number 2? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 2 carries. Amendment number 3, Representative Garra.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number 3. It says to page 16, line 15, following then, and then it talks about a $3 charge. It's a longer amendment. It says conceptual amendment on the top.
6, line 15.
Yeah, 6, line 15. And
okay.
Madam Chair, these the last one and these are all conceptual amendments because the drafter might decide to put them in on a different line or something, but the language is fine. This is what amendment number, well, I move amendment number three.
Object so we can hear it.
Yep. We very purposely tried to track California law on this. There's some argument that if all 50 states come up with different approaches to regulating this area, that the courts are going to find the different state approaches unconstitutional. And so we thought we would go with the state that has among the more comprehensive approaches and then follow their approach. One of their approaches that causes me some concern is that in order to place a security freeze, there are three companies nationally that you would place the security freeze, three credit reporting agencies. In order to place it, California allows for a $10 or $12 charge to place it and remove the freeze. It seems significant. And in the Senate bill on this, they have various provisions where they've done it where it has to be provided for free or at very low cost. So on one hand, I'm sympathetic to the lower cost, and so I'm proposing that it be $3 rather than 10 or 12. But I have conditional language at the bottom that said if the courts find that it's unconstitutional to impose this lower charge, then the charges imposed by the California statute would be the default charge, so $10 and $12. So we'd like to take a shot at making it a $3 charge. You would get the $3 charge if you only do this freeze action once in a five-year period. If there's a consumer who's always imposing freezes on their credit account, then the $10 and $12 charges apply. But for the person who only does it every once in a while, the $3 charge applies. The bill also provides that if you file a police report stating in good faith that your security has been breached, then with proof of the police report, they have to freeze your credit information for free. And that's in there also. But so this just moves it down to $3 to the extent we can do that without violating the Constitution.
Representative Coghill, do you maintain your objection?
I'm still catching up with it, but I won't object.
Objection's been removed. Is there further objection to amendment number three? Okay, hearing none, amendment number three carries. Amendment number four, Representative Guerra.
I move conceptual amendment number four. It says page 6, line 14, insert a new bill section to read, and then it says section 45, 48, 150, prohibition.
Is there an objection? I'll object to hear you talk about it.
Madam Chair, these next two amendments, Senator Guess and Senator Terrio have a bill just like this on the other side. Theirs addresses many, many more subjects, and I think it's a good attempt to address some other subjects that are really important. I don't have my arms around some of them, and I can't tell what some of them do. I don't know enough, and I don't know how well they work or how they work. But on a couple of them, I do, and so I'm borrowing from their bill on a couple of the provisions that I think are real important. Amendment number four says that if somebody contacts the credit reporting agency and the credit reporting agency says there's a freeze on this person's credit, we don't want the credit reporting agency to imply to the car dealer or the furniture store that there's a freeze on the person's credit because they're a bad credit risk or something like that. So it simply says that when the company tells somebody calling that there's a credit freeze, that they not say it in a way that indicates that the person has bad credit. The security freeze is there because the person was concerned about a security breach. And so I thought that was a smart provision of the Guess and Terrio provisions, and we've plagiarized it.
I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection to amendment number four?
Madam Chair, there's also a second part, and I'm just reading that.
I've read it. I don't have a problem with it, but others might.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Gruenberg.
Maybe I want to wait till we finish this amendment. I have a question about number three. I'm slightly slow.
Any further objection to amendment number four? The hearing none, amendment number four carries. Representative Gruenberg.
And I'm not going to ask if we have three reconsider, I don't think. But you said that some constitutional issue about this amendment number three. What's the constitutional issue?
I think you have to be very careful, and I learned this when I had a bill, the House passed it my first year, which tried to regulate email spam. And the more all 50 states regulate an industry differently, the more substantial the differences are, the more likely, just in the most general sense, it becomes that the courts might say that it violates the Commerce Clause of the United States. I personally don't believe that imposing a different security freeze charge in Alaska from what they do in California would be one of those kinds of things that would cause the courts to say that this violates the Constitution, but just to be careful, I put the contingency language in.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra, Amendment Number 5.
Madam Chair, I move Conceptual Amendment Number 5, which says, page 11, line 14, insert a new article in the bill to read, right to file police report regarding identity theft.
Okay.
And
Representative Wilson?
No.
Also one that I plagiarized from the Guestario bill, which I think makes a lot of sense, but I can explain.
Representative Anderson?
I'll object. I understand just in reading on the face of it what it does, but do you have any idea of the fiscal impact, if there would be? Meaning, could there be kind of a conflagration, a big surge of folks doing this? Now I can think of seniors and others that say, I'm going to file a report. Mr. Policeman, could you come out and meet with me, and I'll show you the computer where this happened or the document, and I want to fill out the report.
In truth, and this bill does go to the Finance Committee, there would be some very minor fiscal impact. Right now, the bill says that if you're a victim of identity theft and you file a police report, you don't have, and it's filed in good faith, you don't have to pay the security freeze charge. But it's not clear in every jurisdiction in the state whether there's any form that would let you file a complaint about a security breach. And so we're saying that law enforcement should allow you to file the complaint. Law enforcement doesn't have to do anything about it. They don't have to investigate it if they don't feel like they have the staff. But the consumer at least needs the right to be able to send in the complaint, and then that way they can they can get the free security freeze check. So it just allows them to send in the complaint, but it doesn't require that the law enforcement decide to investigate it.
I maintain my objection a minute. I just think it would be too burdensome on a law enforcement agency. They haven't weighed in. I'm going to object and have you have a vote, hold the vote, vote no, and then contact my contacts in law enforcement to see what their thoughts are on this. Sometimes this proliferates more than you can imagine. When you say it's not really a big deal, they can submit it to another, state troopers could submit it to the Anchorage Police Department and so forth, but how many people are going to file the report? I'd just be interested to know.
Further discussion on Amendment Number 5?
Just real briefly, Section B of the amendment says the law enforcement agency doesn't have to investigate, doesn't have to take any action, that they have the right to allocate their resources the way they see fit.
But through the chair, they still have to fill out the report.
Okay, Madam Secretary, call the roll on Amendment Number 5, please.
Representative Garrett.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Kott?
No.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
5
yeses. We still win in spirit.
So, Amendment Number 5 carries. But Representative Guerra, just on that point, I think Representative Anderson's comments were compelling, and as it goes to finance, I would encourage you to have somebody available to talk about it. I think it's important to have. That's why I voted for it, even if it does involve some resources. But it would probably be good to hear their perspective on it.
I agree, Representative Anderson. Would you mind contacting law enforcement, see if they have a problem? I just delegated. Did you see that?
That's good.
It was his concern.
Subcommittee, and I be the chair.
So, good.
And just let us know if they do.
Okay, Amendment Number 6.
Madam Chair, this is the last amendment. I move Conceptual Amendment Number 6.
Okay, and I'll object. Here you tell us about it.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to have to go line by line on this one. I think they're very technical, but page 2, line 16.
Substitute notice. I don't know what that is.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill.
While he's studying it, each one of the others are a directive in as to how you will notify. And so the number one is written document, electronic document, and then this one is by substitute
okay.
notice.
Okay. Look at that. Representative Coghill just explained the first part of your amendment.
Thank you, John.
May I inquire?
Representative Grunberg.
Is the term, quote, by substitute notice defined, or who's going to decide what you mean by that?
How do we do that?
Representative Kira?
Or is that defined in lines 20 through 24? Is that what you mean by substitute notice? I think, Madam Chair, if I may answer my own question, I think that just to be certain, I think, Representative Guerra, you mean the stuff that's listed on lines 20 through 24, I'm sorry, 20 through 25. And if in fact you do, if that's what you mean, I would suggest that as part of this amendment number six, or at least the first part, if we divide it into parts, that we also add on line 19 between the word provide notice, add the word substitute. So that way you're sure that people know what you mean by the term substitute notice.
Representative Kira?
Yeah. Madam Chair, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to amend amendment number six by deleting those first two lines, page 2, line 16 following number 3, insert by substitute notice. Just delete that part of the amendment. I need to work on that.
Okay. Fair enough. Page 2, line 17.
So the amendment then would provide page 2, line 17. Technically, the word or needs to be inserted after the word $250,000.
Okay.
Page 3, lines 5 through 7. Let me just see. Madam Chair, I'm having a brain freeze, and I'm going to ask Emily to come over and talk to me.
Okay.
I am curious about this portion of the excuse me.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you. Starting where it says page 3, line 5 through 7, and then through the end of the amendment, all of these provisions are the words that come out of the amendment would track the wording of the California statute. And as I read the language, both of them seem to say the same thing, but as a matter of caution, we decided to adopt the exact wording of the California statute on these provisions. We tried to be careful in tracking the California law and apparently missed it on these two provisions.
Representative Grunberg?
I would ask, for the purposes of discussion, to divide the question, that we take the first part of this all the way down to the final little line, page 3, line 12, and call that part A. So we've deleted the first thing here, so we're starting from the portion that's page 2, line 17. That's part A. Page 3, lines 5 to 7, that's also part A.
And Representative then, Grunberg, I don't think we need to make it that complex. Why don't you just state what your concerns are and let's see if we can resolve them.
I see. Okay, well, my concern is on the last part of this,
okay,
which we're not at yet.
Okay.
Do we want to wait until we...
I want you to go ahead and just state what the concern is.
Actual damages might be read to mean special damages only, as opposed to general damages. And you can absolutely ruin a person by an unauthorized disclosure or a fraud or something like that. And I think that we're talking about more than out-of-pocket expenses, but damage to reputation, and also it can significantly ruin their life, basically, if you're accusing them of crimes and stuff like this. So I do not, I mean, I really think we ought to think long and hard before inserting the word actual.
Representative Kira?
Madam Chair, my instinct is that both of them mean the same thing. Damages mean compensatory damages. Actual damages mean compensatory damages. But I'm willing, if Representative Grunberg believes that he's correct, that it makes a big difference on the kinds of compensatory damages you can get, then I'm open.
Well, I don't want it misinterpreted. I would feel much more comfortable if we didn't have the word actual, which could be interpreted for the real people on the committee, could be interpreted as meaning just out-of-pocket expenses, the cost of paying back the bad debt or whatever else, but things that are somewhat intangible, like the loss of your good reputation. They can ruin a person. People have had that. You've seen articles about that. So I'd ask we strike, delete, page 3, line 12, the amendment. It's an amendment to the amendment.
Representative Guerra?
I have no objection either way.
I don't really have an opinion either. I think the court will probably look to all the damages that are there either way, however you phrase it. But let's just make it easy. So if you accept that friendly amendment, I guess it's friendly. I'm not sure he's your friend after this committee, but friendly amendment to strike page 3, line 12 has been accepted. And so we have the amendment as amended back before us. As amended, it deletes the first reference to page 2, line 16, and the last page 3, line 12. So it's the middle two sections. It's amended. It's back before us. Is there any further objection to amended amendment 6? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 6 carries. Are there any further amendments to this bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to move an amendment, but I think that to a small degree, because he didn't have enough background information, but to a small degree, Mr. George's commentary based on the American Council of Life Insurers recommended amendment was compelling enough for me to at least consider in the future you looking at that. And that was on, I won't make an amendment now, but it's good for the record to note this as it goes to finance.
Yeah.
Page 11, the idea that, okay, if it's encrypted, you're okay, but also what if it's a code that is, let's say, less Guerra, but in letters and numbers that someone wouldn't know? I think that's what they're getting at, and I'm sure life insurance companies do that, and they don't have encrypted, but they have it coded, and someone wouldn't know that if that was released.
I agree.
But I won't move it.
We'll sit down with Mr. George afterwards and take a look at the California statute, take a look at his proposal, and it might very well make sense. We just didn't have enough time to take a look at it.
Further discussion before the vote on House Bill 226. Representative Grunberg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. George's other comment dealing with the very final section of the bill, the definition, impelled me to look at this because it would seem to me that anything in sub B, anything in sub A would necessarily be a subcategory. Sub A is page 11, line 21 to page 12, line 2, would necessarily be in sub B. And I asked Emily to get me the California statute on which this was based. And she did, and it's been distributed here, chapter 915, page 4. And I'm just asking, I want to hear what Representative Guerra has to say about this.
Representative Guerra?
It seems to me that the California language is quite clear and well drafted, and I'm wondering how he would feel about conceptually putting that in here rather than this other language, which is somewhat ambiguous.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Grunberg is right about that, and I think on that concern, I think the concern was a valid one. So,
I'm going to make a conceptual amendment, and let's call this, is this amendment number 7?
That's correct.
Number 7. So this is a conceptual amendment number 7. Now, just a question to Representative Guerra. Would this be in place of or be plugged into, it'd be basically in place of 390, the guts of 390. Is that, am I basically correct on that, Les?
Yes, it would be. there are some words that they use in the California statute that don't jibe with the words we use in the Alaska statute, so as long as it was tailored to fit the wording of this bill, that would make sense.
I would ask that we adopt it and delegate Representative Guerra to schmooze the words him and Emily. Is that okay?
So it'll be a conceptual amendment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, with some authority to you.
Objection? Conceptual amendment number 7. Okay, hearing none. Conceptual amendment number 7 carries. Representative Wilson, you want to move the bill out?
Yes, Madam Chair, I really would, because this has happened to me.
Yes.
And it's, and actually, the police came to me and told me that they picked up someone when they, and in their pocket they had my name and my credit card on a piece of paper, and they called me, and then I had to stop all my credit cards and everything. But if that, I mean, just look at everything, that would have, it would have made a difference. And they did ask me to go ahead and contact my credit card company, but don't say anything to anybody else because they were still in the middle of this investigation. So,
but Peggy, I might have had the numbers, I didn't use them.
So I will move CS for House Bill number 226, version L, out of committee with individual recommendation.
As amended?
As amended.
Okay, and so 226 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Is there an objection to the movement of that bill? Okay, hearing none, the bill is moved. That brings House Bill number 190 before us. And the bill's sponsor has left the building. Take a brief Addies. Oh, we won't. We no need to.
Sure. I'm going to have to leave.
Yes. And Representative Coghill is excused starting at 2:45.
See you guys.
Representative Crawford.
Are we taking one more bill or two?
Take a seat.
Can we excuse Tom?
We're just one more bill to 30.
This is it. It's the last bill. Representative Crawford, tell us about House Bill 190.
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to run. I'm going to try and get back here in time for this.
Sure, but not on.
Thank you very much.
And we have two folks online to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm sure everybody on this committee knows, I had the occasion a year ago to sit around a hospital room and think about what I could do to prevent alcohol abuse, drunk driving, victims of the problems that we have around alcohol. So I had a lot of time to think while I was sitting around the hospital room waiting for my wife to come to. And we put a lot of time and effort into penalties for drunk driving, for all types of alcohol abuse. This is a bill that has to do with prevention. It actually stops people from getting the alcohol, getting to the point where they're drunk, getting to the point where they kill people and maim people, and commit many other crimes. What this does is, as a matter of course, right now, people that are under sentence for felony alcohol convictions, judges, as a matter of course, will put orders on them to not to buy, consume, or enter the premises where alcohol is sold, but that those orders aren't enforced because there's no way to identify those people when they go to a bar or go to a package store presently. Those orders are ignored. People get out of court and go directly to a bar sometimes. What this would do is mark the driver's license, or if they've had their driver's license taken away, mark the state ID so that people could identify who those folks are. When I first started this bill, when it was introduced to Labor and Commerce, we had in it that everybody would be, that the establishment owners would be responsible to check for IDs to see if they had these marks on them. Found out that that wasn't, it didn't have the support statewide, so we reduced the scope and made it voluntary. And now, only if the establishment owners want to, they can check for IDs and check for the mark that has the orders from the judge on it. And if they voluntarily do that and find somebody, then what we did was we borrowed the same language from Representative Meyer's so-called Hey Mister bill for underage drinkers, and it gives them the ability to collect $1,000 through a civil fine for those people that are breaking the law. And that's the gist of this bill. It's a voluntary move, but I believe that there are many people. We've talked to the owner of the Brown Jug. He thought this was a good idea. When we talked to him last year, I haven't talked to him recently. They thought that this would be able to, I mean, they'd just be able to continue this on the same way they do with underage drinkers today. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A couple questions. One, have you talked to, we had talked out of committee about like CHAR, the different groups are, but there's all these hospitality groups. I used to work with one. And sometimes I don't agree with them, other times I do, so they're not always instructive to the degree that they make me vote a certain way. But other times with something like this where it directly affects business management and consumer-patron relations, I would be interested in a letter or something. And have you asked them? Or like Lulshin, you mentioned Lulshin at Brown Jug. He has a really good security team. You know, I mean, he's the biggest retailer in the state. Have you asked them for any correspondence that supports, you know, in the writing?
When I talked, I think it was a man named Ed O'Neill.
Yep. Vice President.
When I talked to him last year, what we were going to do is if we had gotten a hearing, I believe he was going to be there to testify online. Don't believe that we've talked to him this year. I haven't gotten a letter or correspondence. I was just going by the fly-in that the CHAR people had the other night, and I talked to a number of people throughout CHAR. I don't think that there's a position by their whole group, but I just talked to a number of those people, and they said as long as it's voluntary, they didn't mind it. The ones that I talked to, they said that it sounded like a good idea to them. Because there is no penalty now under this bill for a establishment owner if they serve alcohol to somebody that's under these orders. It's only voluntary, you know, if they want to check, and that, you know, $1,000 is a pretty good financial incentive to check.
And just supplement, Madam Chair, you mentioned voluntary. We talked when this bill, as Chairman of Labor and Commerce, Representative Cott was chairman that day, and the move moved out to come to Judiciary, and then, of course, the session ended, so you couldn't get it scheduled here. I wasn't there at the final vote, and I didn't hear the dialogue in terms of the delineation voluntary versus not, and I don't see that in here right off the bat. Can you or Heather or someone show, when you say now it's voluntary, it's been changed, where is that?
Well, in the first section there, a person who is not privileged to purchase alcohol under AS 14-16-160 may not knowingly enter or remain in premises licensed under this title. It puts the onus on the person. There's no language in this CS now about the business owner anymore. That has been deleted.
Okay. That's it. I see what you mean. And the only other comment I'd make is I like the idea, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I like the idea in terms of penalties. We already have, I think, a $1,000 fine if you come in underage. They can take your ID. They can prosecute. And there's a good precedent for that to prevent underage drinking. And I think it's been fruitful. And I like your idea to try to curb that. People get out of prison. They're like, hey, I'm going to go right to get some booze. And it's like, no, you're not. We're going to put this on your ID so you can't. The only thing, and from the char folks I spoke with, one comment was made. And the only thing that concerns me is I hope this doesn't lead to added, once it's in statute codified, that you have we were just talking about encryption or a coded symbol or message in the ID that it, exacerbates it to then pretty soon if you've had a felony or if you've had a DUI, maybe that'll be the next amendment that you can put that in there and then someone goes to drink. And it doesn't say on the ID you can't drink, but it says this person's had a DUI. And I don't mean you're recommending that, but it's a slippery slope to pretty soon our information. Then it's like, gosh, how much do you want in this? Because like we've talked of magnetic strips on the back where it has personal information, and already we took off social security number off the driver's license a couple years ago. I just hope we don't go the other way, and this would be the vehicle to do it. But the spirit of your bill I like, I just with that caution.
Madam Chair, that there is a strip on the back of your driver's license presently that gives your information such as your height, weight, and hair color, that sort of thing, so that they can just swipe it. That's the only thing that's mentioned here in the bill is presently written.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, the question has come to my mind along the lines of Representative Anderson, and I support the bill. But the question is whether this might provide a stigma for somebody who has not violating he had a DWI or something, and he goes maybe to apply for a job or something, or shows his ID, and then it says, it has right on there, you have a scarlet letter now, when they're totally law-abiding and not doing anything, and this was just a one-time-only thing, 6 months or a year ago.
Yeah. I see Annie Carpinetti here. You may not want to comment or be prepared to, but or if the sponsor has, that's the only question that has come to my mind is certainly agree with the goals of the bill and all that. Whether or not it's cruel and unusual punishment along those lines that someone has in effect been convicted of a crime, they've served their time, the punishment has been carried forward, does an identifying mark on your driver's license constitute continued punishment? I don't know. Have you looked into that?
It is a stigma to know that you've had enough DUI violations or alcohol-related violations that it rises to the felony level. I think that people should know that you're not to have alcohol, that you can't handle alcohol. Once the person has served their time, this goes away. Once they're no longer under the orders, they're not under probation or anything, this goes away. They can get a normal driver's license. But I think that as long as the judge has ordered them not to be able to buy a consumer, enter the premises, then they should have that stigma.
So it's Annie, do you know? I just don't know. I know there are some in the lower 48. Some states have done license plates that indicate whether someone has been convicted of a DUI. There's all form of kind of scarlet lettering is what it's called. And I say it with all respect, Representative Crawford, because your heart is clearly in the right place, and I know that a drunk driver has profoundly impacted your family, and so I say it with the utmost of sensitivity and respect for you. I am simply trying to look at the constitutional aspects of it, and I'm just wondering, has anybody looked into that? Annie, do you have any thoughts?
I have not looked into it.
Okay.
I would be surprised if it would.
Okay.
It is a limited period. Like I said, it's a sentence. So I would
for which it's on the driver's license.
Yes, and then you can go back and get it.
Okay.
I'm happy
to do that. But so, and then explain that part to me, Representative Crawford. So it would go on the driver's license, and I don't even know what you're envisioning, what it would look. Can you describe to me or?
We left that to the division of DMV. They said that they would devise a way to show that.
Isn't it a gentleman in a cowboy hat drinking a beer and then it has a cross through it?
Dwayne Bannock is on the line. Mr. Bannock, have you been following the committee discussion, and could you just give us an idea of what other states have used, if they're using it, or what you would envision this mark that would be on a person's driver's license?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. We are unfamiliar with any state that has adopted such a program as this. As a result, I can't answer that question.
Okay. Okay, is there any testimony that you would like to offer additionally to that?
Thank you, Madam. We reviewed the minutes of when this bill was heard in Labor and Commerce. Representative Anderson had alluded to that meeting. While I understand that this bill is a little bit different than the original bill that was drafted, the part that concerns your Division of Motor Vehicles are the same concerns that we had then. And that is in so much as testimony from both myself and representatives of the Alaska court system, there is not a direct link of communication pertaining to the Division of Motor Vehicles to a person in section number 2 of the bill, the last line where it says, as part of a sentence for conviction of a crime or as a condition of probation or parole. We have no direct contact, immediate direct contact with the courts when either one of those situations take place. So the question that the Division of Motor Vehicles will continue to ask, again respectfully, is we have no idea how many customers we should be dealing with or could be dealing with, and exactly what would be expected of the Division of Motor Vehicles if, let's just say, the court faxed us over the court order. Would we then revoke the driver's privilege until the driver came to the DMV to get another driver's license? What is there a time frame that's involved? Those are the questions that we feel are specific to section number 4. We understand section number 4 very, very well, but we're concerned about how it is we're going to get the timely information so that we can act on it accordingly.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dwayne, I had another question to that end. What if, two questions, actually Representative Kant gave me an idea too. First, what if then someone with the do not serve emblem or symbol on the driver's license goes into an establishment that serves liquor and it is not seen or caught by the owner or the manager or the server and they are served? Would then the ABC board investigator, I mean, would they have to be caught? Would they be sanctioned by the ABC board as the provider of the alcohol because they inadvertently didn't notice the license? Secondly, what would the fiscal note be to the DMV for advertising this, that hey, bar owners, you have to look out for these new licenses? And then three, what if someone, you're both over 21, your buddy has this ID that says don't serve me, and you buy some alcohol and give it to your buddy? Is there prosecution or a crime for that? And maybe Dwayne can think about that. It looks like Representative Crawford wants to answer.
You'll have to keep me on track to get all three of them.
Sure.
Let's see. The first one was
bar liability if they don't catch.
We were very specific that the owner of the establishment is not liable here. It's just the person that's under the orders that commits a crime if they try to buy a consumer and enter the premises.
And then through the chair, the second was the fiscal impact on DMV to have to notify folks that there's this new license.
The DMV would be able to charge the person that has to get the new license or state ID. They could charge them for the cost of issuing a new one.
And then, through the chair, Mr. Urbanek, is that accurate? Is there a cost, or is that something that you're saying you don't know yet what it would, how it would impact you?
Representative Anderson, through the chair, correct. We don't, because we don't know what the quantities are, it will be very difficult for us to answer that question. I might add, though, your Division of Motor Vehicles, every dollar that we collect is either defined by statutory authority or regulatory authority. So I'm presuming, I'm going to go out on a limb here and presume that the committee and the bill sponsor recognizes that in order to pull this off, there would be a cost. Representative Crawford has indicated and testified in the past, and we've spoken about it, that his intent for only the customers that are involved in this to be responsible for paying for it. I would respectfully suggest that in order for that to take place, that too would require a statutory change, because right now, by statute, everyone pays the same amount for their driver's license. It's $20 for a renewal, it's $15 for a duplicate. So as a result of that, we don't get to raise the rate on one group of people because we do take our authority from the statutes.
And then just the last question was, and I don't know if Representative Crawford can answer, this is something to research. I won't hold up anything, but what would happen if someone bought someone else?
That's already against the law. We don't have to change anything for that to change.
But what if, okay, so you mean if someone's over 21 and they just got out of, left prison and on the court or on probation, which you can't drink, and that's you, let's say, and I buy you a drink not knowing that, you're saying this wouldn't affect that. There's laws that say the person is...
That's already there, but, you know, they're not responsible for looking at a person's driver's license to find that out. So that's not going to change.
Okay. And then, Representative Crawford, have you thought about... the only thing I think that would make the bill a little better would be... working with the DMV regarding this, have you thought of, you know, so that you would set out there can be a fee assessed, a reasonable fee, and then sort of some statutory instructions? I see Mr. Bannock's point that he's not sure what Dudian imposes on them.
We thought that we had that worked out when we changed the draft the last time. I told Mr. Bannock at that time, you know, that I would be glad to put anything into the bill to make his life easier, that he wanted to have. And I thought we had taken care of his concerns. Apparently we haven't, but we'll be glad to. We'd be glad to make for somebody to make amendment to that effect. That would be great. You know, I'm just here to help this process along, because there are people that are being killed and maimed every day. Every day we delayed this. I mean, Representative Joe Green tried this for years, tried to get something through. I believe what's different now is the fact that we can do this as a voluntary thing, and we have a financial incentive for people to actually check the driver's license. It makes this a much more palatable bill to all the people that are involved. But we've got to do something to stop this. We've got to start preventing the alcohol from getting in the hands of the people that are causing the majority of the trouble. The ones that continually do this over and over again. The person that hit my wife was a .38. You can't get to that point without a lot of practice. Yeah. I mean, he was a multiple repeat offender. Those are the people that I'm targeting. Those are the people that are populating our jails. They're populating our hospitals with their victims, and we've got to do something.
Representative Kara.
Madam Chair, I think, and I understand Mr. Bannock's concerns. He had a similar concern with a bill that we've been working on, and the DMV statutes are a bit restrictive. So I think what we would need to do would do a conceptual amendment giving the Department of Motor Vehicles the authority to charge an enhanced reasonable driver's license fee for issuing licenses under the section, so I'm going to offer that amendment when we get to the time.
Yeah, and then the only other part of it that I'm just trying to think about, it's silent as to procedure or duty on the part of DMV, which leads me to believe that, Dwayne, while you would like to know the right thing to do and so on, that you could probably come up with whatever policies you wanted. I don't see anything in the bill that criminalizes or in any way makes the DMV liable for a certain method of responding to the information that they get regarding a person who would have this put on their driver's license. So it's probably like any other program in that you'd have to go through some proposals and think about how you do it. I guess I'm unclear as to whether you'd prefer the bill to spell out a certain set of instructions that you ought to go through, or whether you'd like the latitude to put the program into place as you see fit.
Madam Chair, that's a very interesting question, and thank you for it. One of the items that came out of the Labor and Commerce Committee was pertaining to the subject of probation or parole. And while it is true that we have a form of communication with the courts, because much of what the court does is in our bailiwick, probation and parole, according to the testimony given in Labor and Commerce, is that that's done through the Department of Corrections. And to date, we have zero connectivity there, completely zero, not even bad, just zero. So the part that has to be addressed, in my opinion, on top of the fee issue that Representative Guerra alluded to, is exactly what does happen to the person that we're speaking to, the person that is addressed in Section 2 of the bill. Is the person required to surrender their unmarked driver's license? Do they have the ability? And one of the issues that I had spoken with the bill sponsor on is there's not a day that goes by that we don't have customers here at the DMV that sign an affidavit that they have lost their driver's license, like physically lost it. I can't find it. So if that were to, if this person were to come to the DMV, and let's recognize that they're a bad person to start with, and they tell the DMV that they have lost their old driver's license, which is clearly unmarked, and they come today to the DMV to get their new marked driver's license, now they're wandering around with two driver's licenses in their pocket. Guess which one they're going to show at Brown Jug? So that's some of the deficiencies that we've seen in order to reach the same intended goal that I believe all of us are looking for. Every one of us here at the Division of Motor Vehicles concur with the bill sponsor that something needs to be done about our drunk driving problems in Alaska. However, what we look for from a representative Roepberg, I believe, made the relationship of the cost slash benefit ratio and relationship. What are we actually going to do as a result of this law being passed? Who's not going to be buying alcohol? What happens if you don't get your driver's license marked? Because quite frankly, while I appreciate the idea that from a vendor's point of view, checking the identification becomes optional, based on my reading of the way the bill is written, it's almost optional that you would get the new marked driver's license. What if I don't want to? I just don't go to the DMV. Is there anything that I'm doing wrong now because I haven't done that? Those are some of the questions that we believe should be fully investigated and answered. Clearly, as the head bureaucrat here at the DMV, we can process anything that we're directed to process. We can design it. We can do anything of that the committee, that the legislature wants us to do. But again, we have to go back and say, exactly how are we going to get the information, what do we do with it, and is it just as much of a voluntary program for the person as it is for the vendor? So not trying to be just Mr. Negative here, but I truly believe that in order for our organization to fully comply with the law, those issues must be addressed.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, it's fine to bring up problems that you see. It's another thing to give suggestions about how to get to the place where we want to go. If you truly do believe that this is a laudable effort, then what we need are suggestions about how to get there. What we had talked about was that when the courts make them surrender their driver's license or their state ID, then if they go to an establishment where they're required to, where somebody checks, if they don't have it, they don't get served. So it's a voluntary thing. Oh, absolutely, they can continue to look for places that don't check them, and they can get alcohol there. That's the trade-off that I've gone through in this bill to get the thing through. Sure, I think that there'll probably be some ways for some people to get alcohol, but that's not what I'm trying to do in this bill. I'm trying to cut down on the number of people that are able to buy alcohol. I believe that the $1,000 fine is a good financial incentive that most people will start following this. And if they don't have one, well, then they won't be able to buy alcohol in those establishments that choose to look for it. I can't stop it from, my God, they could go buy Listerine. But let's try to get there from here as far as trying to limit the amount of alcohol that gets into the hands of those problem drinkers. Now, I'd be glad to do whatever I can with Mr. Bannock to try to get this done. I think that when people come in to apply for a driver's license, that they should be able to go online with the courts to see if they're under orders. I believe that the courts have got a way of identifying those people that are under court orders. I don't believe it's that hard. I believe that if I can get cooperation, that we can get there from here.
Okay, further questions for the sponsor? I have one more person to testify. Representative Guerra.
Just for whoever knows this answer, right now when you're convicted of a DWI, do you have to turn your license and your state ID into the court right then, or we're not sure about that?
Not on the first one. And this doesn't come into effect on the first one.
This only comes into effect on the second one.
I believe that's how it works.
And on the second one, you have to turn it into the court, the license?
I wasn't listening. I'm sorry.
So the somebody convicted of a second DWI has to turn the license into the court? Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, for the record, Doug Wolliver, administrative attorney for the court system. Representative Guerra, with DUIs, it's not as big of a problem because the officer seizes your license on the roadside. With other offenses, it can be more problematic, but there you lose it when he pulls you, or he or she pulls you over.
You never get it back? You have to get a new license? Is that?
You get a temporary license that's issued by DMV, and then Mr. Bannock probably understands from there on how you get that back. But at least initially in those cases, you lose your license.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So actually what happens is these people don't have a license. So there won't be a question of having two licenses.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, at least initially. Now, it can get more complicated. You could lose your license, get it back again because you're litigating your DUI, and then have a license again, and then you've got a license. And there are some practical problems when the court tries to seize it and you say, you know what, Your Honor, I lost that. But it's less of a problem, like say with DUI, because at least initially your license is seized.
Representative Representative Caro?
So it seems what you would need, and this doesn't seem like brain surgery, if you didn't turn your license in to the police officer, you have to certify under oath as part of your conviction to the court that if you didn't turn it in, you don't have one. So you could lie, but you're lying to a judge and you're stating it under penalties of perjury. That's not going to be as easy as lying to an average person. And B, there should also, I think, be a marked license as provided under this bill while your case is pending as well. So when you go to DMV, you don't get a clean license. You get a license with the kind of mark that Representative Crawford is talking about. And then only after your period of no drinking probation is done with, then you can get a clean license. It seems like that would work.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that would probably fill a hole, right? The temporary license you receive from DMV should have that designation on it.
Okay, I have one further person to testify. Thank you, Mr. Williver. Sure. Oh, Representative Cott.
Mr. Williver, maybe, or Department of Law. Again, Section 2, we're saying here that if there's a condition, as part of a condition of probation, I've been told, because I, for whatever reason, came involved with this, I've been told I can't consume alcohol. That's what the judge says. Part of your probation, you can't have any alcohol for 6 months or 1 year, whatever the case might be. And then in Section 1, in statute, we're saying if the judge has told you that, then you can't come into these premises. I guess the question I would have is are there situations in which perhaps we could be tying a judge's hand because he's gone on to say, okay, we don't want you drinking, but maybe my job occupation, maybe I'm a waiter, and this is a licensed premise that serves alcohol. But he's given me, the judge that is, has given me that luxury to continue to earn a living. I'm just trying to figure out, in my mind, if we are perhaps restricting the judge's conditions for probation.
Through the chair, Representative Cott, I think the judge would have the discretion with his probationary powers or power to set conditions of probation to make allowances of that kind. A judge certainly could just say, you can't enter a present premise of any kind, or maybe the judge says you can't enter a premise with the exception of you work at a performing arts center that sells wine or something. And I don't think
not
that...
Changing anything.
Representative Crawford?
The judge has that.
Why don't you come forward to the...
We're not changing anything there. The judge has that ability to make those orders presently. This is just a way of enforcing it. That's the only thing that we're changing.
That's right.
Representative Cobb?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Williver. We have one further person to testify, Brian Talbot Clark with MAD. Brian, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Barely.
Okay, I'll try to speak up then.
There, but much better.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Talbot Clark. I live at 3910 Drive Number 1 in Anchorage, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. As president of the volunteer board of directors of the Anchorage chapter, I'm here to express the support of Mothers Against Drunk Driving for the proposed legislation. Like any single piece of legislation, this bill is not going to solve the problem of drunk driving or of domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, or any of the many social ills that are fueled by alcohol, areas in which we so often hear Alaska, unfortunately, leading the nation. For example, when I volunteer on MAD drunk driving impact panels, we have a frequent speaker who presents to other offenders her own story of how she killed three of her friends the very first time she made the choice to drink and get behind the wheel. So I have to acknowledge that this step would not have addressed her situation. But let me tell you my story. One of my dearest friends, by the name of Jesse Withrow, in the year 2000, was riding her bicycle on the sidewalk when that same piece of sidewalk was crossed by a truck driven by a man with six prior DUIs, a man who was under orders not to drink, consume alcohol, drive a car, who was not wearing his seatbelt. His two-year-old son, who was in the truck with him, was not wearing his seatbelt either. And my dear friend Jesse Withrow, her bicycle was ended up 75 feet away. She was a very intelligent and a very responsible person, responsible to the end. She was wearing her helmet, and so when she was lying in the hospital the next day, her mother was able to cradle her and stroke her hair and tell her that it was all right to go. This is an issue about choices. In this case, we're talking about a choice made by people who are under orders not to drink, whether they're going to violate that order. And this is about a way of helping them to make the right choice, making it easier for them to make the right choice. Like any choice, you can kind of imagine a bell curve, where on one end of it, you've got people who are going to get around it any way they can, whether it's through a fake license, getting somebody else to buy the booze, whatever it's going to be. On the other end, you've got people who are afraid of any consequences, and they're going to follow it no matter what. Most people are going to be somewhere in the middle, where if they're presented with temptation, it kind of depends on how much temptation is it, what are the consequences, how hard is it to get around it. And when we can set up an obstacle like this, we know that we're going to move a few people from barely making the wrong choice to barely making the right choice. And so maybe we only save a few lives. But the question I have to ask is, do we waste an opportunity to save even a few lives with just a little effort? This bill gives us that opportunity, and I urge you not to waste it. On behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and of myself and for Jesse, I urge you to support this bill. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Brian, for your testimony. There are questions? Okay, hearing none. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill number 190? Is there anybody else online? Okay, hearing none, we'll close public testimony. That brings the bill back before us. Are there amendments? Representative Guerra.
Chair, Representative Crawford's aide is bringing over a conceptual amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment number one, which says conceptual amendment and starts with the words, while a prosecution for a DWI.
Okay. I'll object just to hear you explain it and let me read it.
Sure. It does two things. It addresses the two concerns we've heard. One concern is that it's possible after the police take your license after arresting you that you can get another license without a marking on it before your conviction. And so we say that while your prosecution for your second or subsequent DWI is pending, and then after conviction, as long as you have this restriction on your right to consume alcohol, as long as any of those things are still continuing, the license the DMV issues shall be a license that has the marking that's provided for under the statute, so that there won't be this loophole of time when you can get a license that would not have the marking. That would be the part one. And then part two addresses Mr. Bannock's concern about the state's authority to charge more money for a license or an ID with these markings, and we want to clearly give them the authority to charge more for a license or an ID like that. And though I just have one question, and that's for Ms. Carpinetti, I think. I'm correct in one of the common probation conditions in a DWI is a condition that you not consume alcohol, or a condition that you not consume alcohol while driving? And we only want this to apply, we only want the special license to apply when the condition is the condition not to consume alcohol, correct? Yeah, so the amendment's written the way I want it to.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Just a technical question on the amendment. Line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which says the state shall only issue a license Shouldn't the shall be may?
Sure. I think that's right.
I'd ask that be considered a technical change on there, changing the shall to may.
Okay. Friendly amendment is accepted, so that brings conceptual amendment number one as amended back before us. I remove my objection. Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing none, conceptual amendment number one carries. Further amendments to House Bill number 190. Representative Gruenberg.
I thought Mr. Bannock said that how would he know when there was such a condition put on the defendant's license? There's no mechanism in here requiring the court system to notify the DMV. Shouldn't there be?
You want to make a conceptual amendment to it?
Representative Crawford, do you want to come back up to the...
You would like to make a conceptual amendment to that, Representative Gruenberg, that would be fine. I'm sure that there will be a fiscal note that will go along with that. I believe that we had had that worked out without the amendment, but if you want to, that it's certainly in the purview of this committee to do that.
I would ask, I'd like to hear from Mr. Woolover and Mr. Bannock on that. I thought, and maybe I'm wrong, that's what Mr. Bannock
said. Mr. Woolover and then Mr. Bannock? Mr. Woolover?
Again, Madam Chairman, Doug Woolover from the court. Right now, the court transmits to the DMV any judgment that affects a driver's license.
May I inquire?
Representative
Is that required by a statute somewhere?
The Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I don't know if it's required by a statute or not, but it's done. The question is how it's done right now. There are paper judgments, and there's a time delay, and in the future, we hope to have all this stuff done electronically so it's instant. But all court judgments that affect a driver's license go to DMV.
Maybe if you could stay there, could we ask Mr. Bannock? Mr. Bannock, are you on the line still, sir?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you.
Have you heard this dialogue, that my question and Mr. Willover's answer?
Yes, sir, and I concur on the court order, but please keep in mind that Section 2 makes reference to basically two different actions. Court order or condition of probation or parole. And I had earlier testified that while we do have a delayed communication with the court system, we have zero communication with Department of Corrections, who I'm led to believe is the governing body of the second part of this, condition of probation or parole.
May I inquire?
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. About how long, I'm asking both of you gentlemen, how long does it take to, from the date that the condition is imposed until you get it, Mr. Bannock?
Mr. Representative, through the chair, I'm going to defer on that for just a brief moment. With my number one driver's licensing manager, Carrie Hennings, from a timeline.
We get them fairly rapidly, about 10 days, and then it takes up to 2 weeks to get the data entered.
Between 10 days and 21 days for manual entering into our system.
But as I understand it, Mr. Woolover, that will be changing one of these days.
To the chair, Representative Gruenberg, eventually we'd like to transmit all our information electronically, but I don't have a date for that.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah. I'm going to deal with this court system and then corrections. And I'm just wondering to the bill sponsor whether, under the circumstances, I'd be prepared, if you wanted, to offer an amendment that would be consistent with current practice. I don't want to attach a fiscal note unless you want it, because I'm afraid that might jeopardize the bill. Mm-hmm. That being said, would you like something through the chair? I don't want to get into a situation like the speaker said, you can't look anybody but you.
Right. That's a new rule, or the old rule being enforced.
Thank you. Would you like to have something like that in here?
Whatever it takes to...
I'll support the bill either way. It's up to you.
Meet your approval.
In the meantime, Representative Wilson has a question.
I thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know the law. So is there ever a possibility that the person is not supposed to drink, but he can drive. And if that happens, maybe he has to go to work, and so the judge says you can go drive back and forth. Is there, so then...
Oh, limited licenses, sure. That happens all the time.
Okay, so in those instances, would that that limited license then have to say that he couldn't drink? Is that how it works?
No.
Okay. I just needed to clarify.
Maybe Mr. Williver, you can explain.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Lots of judges impose drinking restrictions on people who've committed crimes under the influence of alcohol unrelated to driving. You could have an assault that you committed under the influence, and the judge says you can't drink, but it has nothing to do with driving.
I think that
Representative Wilson?
I guess what I'm trying to get figured out is whether they then call the or send a letter or something to DMV and say, there has to be a change in this license. Does that happen every time? Because if it was, I mean, how does DMV know that they can't drink, but they can drive? Because it has nothing to do with the driving.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this would be a new type. We would have to transmit that information. Right now, there isn't a restriction on your license. This bill would allow the court to limit, put the restriction on the license, so, or at least creates the enforcement mechanism. So we would then be sending that information to DMV.
So just to be clear, it'd be an additional thing for DMV to process. The way it is now, we've already allowed the court, I'm not even sure it's through statute, I think it's just through court orders, to say we will, as a penalty, limit this person's driver's license abilities, and we're compelled that they have to get to work every day or pick their kids up, so this will be a temporary license issue that they can drive during these hours, so on and so forth. That is transmitted to the DMV right now. Under the new bill, if it passes, what would happen is that an additional thing would be transmitted that would say further the judge has ordered that this individual not be allowed to drink, and so it may be that they have both a driving restriction and a drinking restriction, or it may just be that they have a drinking restriction, but that information would come to the DMV. Sounds like in 10 days it takes the DMV a couple of weeks to process. If the new system comes into place, hopefully it could come quicker than that. But then it's up to the DMV, should the bill pass, then to go ahead and figure out what way they're going to go ahead and identify that limitation on the license. So, Representative Guerra?
Madam Chair, I think I might have created a constitutional problem with my amendment. I'm not so sure. My instinct, my belief is that you should be able to, if you've already had a DWI and you're onto your second DWI, even when the case is pending, we should be able to mark a license. But I don't know that constitutionally we can mark somebody's license if they haven't been convicted just because the case is pending. And so I was trying to address the loophole of somebody going out and quickly getting a new license before they get convicted. And but I'm worried that what I did is not enforceable. So I think we need to revoke amendment number one, and what I'm going to ask is that the bill carrier just figure out if they can close that loophole by the time of the next committee. I know they'd want to make their bill stronger if they could, but...
Do you want to make a motion to rescind our action in adopting amendment number one?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move to rescind our action in adopting amendment number one.
Is there an objection? Okay, hearing none, amendment number one has been rescinded. Representative Gruenberg, one moment. Would you like to keep, Representative Guerra, the reference to the state having the authority to charge the enhanced fee in the form of a new amendment?
Sure.
Okay, amendment number two.
Madam Chair, I offer amendment number two, which would say that the state has the authority to charge a higher fee for a state ID or a license that contains the markings required by this bill, a higher fee than they do for other licenses and IDs.
Okay, and so amendment number two before us, giving the DMV the clear authority. Do you have an objection to that amendment, Representative Gruenberg?
No, it was originally to
the... And your comment is out of order. Is there an objection to amendment number two? Okay, hearing no objection, amendment number two carries. Representative Gruenberg, further amendments to the bill?
Well, it was to the motion to rescind.
Okay.
And I'm sure that the judge could do that as a condition of bail.
Representative Gruenberg, you know, why don't you spend time talking about it with the bill sponsor after the hearing, and you guys can work it out. It's 3:30 now. We're a half hour over the committee's time. So at this point, if somebody'd like to make a motion on the bill, if those are the committee's wishes. Representative Cott.
Madam Chairman, just if we're going to move this bill, I want, for the record, for Mr. Williver to also to re-comment on the concern that I had earlier, because in my view, if you look at Section 2 of the bill, if as a condition for probation I am told that I cannot consume alcoholic beverages for 6 months, that's a condition of probation. The judge has no authority to grant any leniency to me as a busboy at the How How restaurant that has an alcoholic beverage license to go to work. Because in Section 1 of the bill, it says if you fall in the category of Section 2, you can't go to the premise. Now, Doug, please correct me if I'm...
Through the chair, Representative Cott pointed out to me I may have been in error earlier. It's true that a judge can tailor his conditions of probation to allow that kind of thing, but it's also, I think, clear once you've issued a license that has an alcohol restriction on it, then Section 1 comes into play, and regardless of what conditions of probation may or may not have been, Section 1 says you can't enter a licensed premise. So I think Representative Cott is right. It's the license in Section 1 that limits your access. And what you can and can't do with a limited license is spelled out in Section 1, not the conditions of probation. So I believe Representative Cott is right.
Representative Crawford, do you want to have a seat? Responding to Representative Cott's concern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But even though that is the restriction under the license, it's still at the discretion of the judge at the time that they put the miscreant under orders to limit the orders any way he sees fit, whether it's, you know, he could just say that you're not to buy or consume, but he could say on condition of your employment, you can enter the premises. It's up to the judge. He has that discretion. Thank you.
Well, but Representative Crawford, I think what Representative Cott is saying, and I don't know if you intended to do this, but is that if a judge wanted to say that as a condition of your probation, we don't want you to drink, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that because the bill then refers you back to Section 1, if a restriction is placed on a person not to drink, if it goes on further to say they're not even allowed to enter or remain in premises licensed under the title. So I'm not sure you intended to do that. It may be that you want to say that they may not knowingly enter or remain in premises licensed under the title for the purposes of consuming alcohol.
Madam Chair, like the way I understood this, the judge, as a matter of course, issues orders that says not to buy, consume, or enter the premises. But if they wanted to say only not to buy or consume, he has the discretion to do that. So on the mark, instead of saying B, C, and E, it just B and C. You can certainly be discretionary on the mark, I would imagine.
I think it's probably better to be clear. I think Representative Cott has made a good catch. I mean, I think that's a fairly, what we're sort of doing is taking the punishment to a higher level. You could even extend it out to say that, you know, if a restaurant had an alcohol license and you were prohibited by a judge to consume alcohol, but yet you were in, let's say, the Bradley House is up the street from me, that's a bar and a restaurant, and you were there to consume food, mm-hmm. Technically, under Section 1 of this bill, you would be in violation of the law, I think.
The only penalty would be that if a person came in, it certainly wouldn't be on the Bradley House. I mean, they wouldn't have a problem. but they would be able to charge somebody that came into their restaurant or bar if there was alcohol sold there and they were under those orders. That's
Representative Crawford, then what I'm understanding you to say, let be very clear on this, is that what you would propose under your bill is that a mark would be placed on someone's driver's license if a judge restricts them from consuming alcohol, and that you would then allow enforcement of that through a civil penalty that could go so far as to say, we will now allow you to stop somebody, look at their license, and get a $1,000 civil reward for asking them not to be in your premise, even if they're not consuming alcohol, even if they're there to eat halibut filet with their family?
If they're under the judge's orders not to be...
I completely reject that.
All right. But that's...
I'm shocked that that's the motive.
The when the judge puts you under orders not to enter the premises presently, that's a law that that's already there. We're not changing that. We're only changing the ability to enforce that law. People have proven that they're not capable of handling alcohol. That's what the judge puts on their orders. I'm not changing what the judge puts on their orders. I'm giving them
You're suggesting that there are judges in the state.
They do it
that are
presently.
Writing orders that say that individuals cannot even enter the premises of places. I mean, I'd like to hear, Mr. Woolover, if this is the case. I mean, because there are people that do commit these terrible crimes, and I agree they should not be drinking. And I'm even compelled that perhaps there should be this mark and this method. I was very compelled by Brian Talbot Clark's testimony that, you know, don't let the perfect get in the way of the possible. That being said, that's a tremendous leap to then say that anybody who's licensed, that has an alcohol license, those premises are now off limits to these individuals to eat, to gather for a birthday party of a family member or coworker, to secure employment in the form of a busboy or a waiter. Is that what our courts are doing?
Madam Chairman, I think it's not uncommon at all for a court to issue a condition of probation if the person not consume alcohol or enter a premise that serves alcohol. Now, it's up to the judge to do that. It's typically done in more serious cases. Not all judges do them. Some judges do them a lot, but that's not at all an uncommon condition of probation.
Representative Guerra.
I think probably to address your concern, I'm not sure about this. I'll ask the sponsor, but I understand Representative Cutts' point that you don't want to keep somebody from working, and you don't want to keep somebody from going into a restaurant to eat food. So what if we, on page 1, line 10, said a person who is not privileged to purchase alcohol may not knowingly enter or remain on a premises license in this title to obtain alcohol for personal consumption. And therefore, you could work, you could serve it to somebody, you could eat a steak while somebody else in the booth next to you was drinking a beer. It seems like that covers it.
I think that's fine.
Further discussion, Representative Wilson?
Well, it is a fact that some people just absolutely cannot do it. And so if the judge, maybe this has been their umpteenth, time that they're before him, and the judge is saying, I'm not going to let you even go into a place. There's plenty of other places that they can eat that they don't have a license, and there's plenty of other places they could work where it doesn't have a license. So I guess I'm not hung up about you can't go into that place.
And see, and I'm not certain about that, particularly in small communities where you may only have a couple of restaurants. I would think it would be common that the restaurant would have a liquor license and a restaurant license. And so then, I don't know all the scenarios, but I can envision, in effect, you're saying, in a smaller community, I mean, you can't go out to supper with your family. You can't go out for any other purpose. Representative Guerra?
Yeah, I
think actually Representative Wilson's point's a good one, but I think it can be solved by the court order. So you have two things going on. One, you have the court order, and the court could issue an order saying you are in such danger of relapsing that you're not even allowed to go on a premises that serves alcohol. And then if you do, you violated probation and you can get extra jail time. But you don't have to solve that problem with what you say on the license. So the license can simply say you're not entitled to be on a premises in order to obtain alcohol for personal consumption. A judge can up the ante and say, and you, on top of that, I'm not even going to let you go into one of those places. And then if you violate that, then you forget about the license rule. You violated probation and you're in trouble there. So we wouldn't take that discretion away from a judge.
I forgot that some places might not have a place like that. I was thinking Anchorage or something.
Yeah, in Anchorage you'd have no problem.
Cake you do.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Several things. First of all, is there anything in here that allows them to put a mark on a state ID? Because some people don't drive, but they have been involved in a crime of whatever type, but they don't have a driver's license now. And I think that there should, if they're not allowed to, as a condition of conviction or something, to be on premises, that we should have something in here that allows the same kind of a mark to be put on a state ID.
That's, Madam Chair.
Representative Crawford.
Where it says, or identification card is the same as a state ID.
Oh, okay, so that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Here. Okay. The other question
does have a further referral to finance.
I have a couple of them. Okay. I'm not being
yeah, and I'm just saying I want to wrap up. It's 20 till 4.
Secondly, on line 7 it says for conviction of a crime there could be a condition of bail that doesn't allow you to be on a licensed premise too.
Madam Chair, there may be, but I didn't want to get into it until somebody had been convicted.
Okay.
I mean, that was the intention. That was what
and
the
finally,
people...
Finally, one other thing that has been mentioned, it could be conviction of a crime not under DWI, but some other crime like discharge of a weapon while intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
You also chose not to get into that.
Right.
Okay, fine.
You've made two clear lines. Okay, so Representative Guerra, this would be amendment number 3.
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment number 3, which would say at page 1, line 10, after the word title, insert the words, to obtain alcohol for personal consumption.
Is there an objection to that amendment, amendment number
3? Sure.
It would be page 1, line 10. It's the amendment we discussed, to obtain alcohol for personal consumption. Objection? Okay, hearing none. Amendment number 3 carries. Further discussion or motions on House Bill number 190 as amended? Representative Guerra?
Chair, I move House Bill 190, Labor and Commerce, as amended with personal recommendations and fiscal note from this committee.
Is there an objection to the movement of that bill? Okay, hearing none. House Bill number 190 as amended has moved from this committee on to the Finance Committee. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that you have made a much better bill by your work, and I appreciate the work of all the committee members.
Thank you, Representative Crawford. Thank you, members, for your patience. Okay, we're adjourned.